short version is see Jumbo. Jumbo.
See Jumbo.
Try it again. Jumbo.
Jumbo.
Jumbo. Glad to be here. My name is Wekesa Olatunji Mazimoyo. Can you hear me in front of the mic, or is it important that I stay here? Okay. I'm also asking my technical people. Is it okay? I'm the kind that moves and I want to be close to you. First, I want to introduce myself and let you know why you hear this African name, Wekesa Olatunji Mazimoyo, and I'm dressed in these African clothes, and you don't hear an African accent. What's that about? Well, I was born in Fayetteville, North Carolina, many, many moons ago. At that time, when I was born in Fayetteville, North Carolina, it was not a pleasant place to be if your skin was dark. We would come into town and it said, "Welcome to Fayetteville, home of the Ku Klux Klan." That's the billboard we were greeted with. Black was considered ugly. I didn't want to be that. Tarzan, those old Tarzan movies, sometimes they come on late, late at night, you might think. The old Tarzan movies that had African people or darker skinned people depicted as foolish. As foolish. I didn't want to do that. So at that time, I was not proud of the African part of me. I was American. American. Not connected with the African part of me because I didn't want to be connected to cowards and imbecility and shame. Fortunately for me, a short, dark-skinned black man came out of Augusta, Georgia, singing a song, much like singers come on now and light fire under you. His name was James Brown, and he started singing a song. Anybody got any guesses? Young folks only. See how far they go back. Okay. How many of you know James Brown? Okay, we got a couple of hands. Okay, now all the folks in the room, you can give a guess. What do you guess? Say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud. Now this was transformative for me. Because before that time, I was ashamed. And I started to want to know more about this part of me. And I started to read and dig. And I did that all through high school. This happened in junior high school. I did that all through high school. And then I went to college and I kept on reading and researching and digging and talking to people. And I began to be so proud of this African part of me, a part that I used to be ashamed of, that one day I said, I want to celebrate this African part. In college, you want to celebrate something. What do you think about doing? Party! But I didn't have the kind of money to throw a party that would be commensurate, that would equal this pride that was bubbling up inside. And after all, you can get so stoned and then you go to sleep. And I wanted this party to last for a long time. So I decided that I would change my name. And I went on a research quest to change my name, to learn about Africa and African people and the names. And I took Wekesa, which means the harvest. It's from the Abaluya people in Kenya. I took Olatunji, which is from West Africa, and it means honor and riches reawakened. And I took Mazimoyo, which means water of life, one who gives a lot of himself or herself. And that's from the Ngoni people in Malawi, a north of migration of Zulus. And my dad had a fit. And my mother wanted to know that somebody got in my head and put some stuff in it. You know how parents get kind of concerned about you when you start doing something a little bit different. Well, they were really concerned. My father was concerned that I would not get a job or that even people like you would think that I have nothing to offer you because I have this African name. My mother just wanted to know that I was kind of doing it on my own and kind of got wrapped up in something. Once she learned that, she took an African name. Her name was Tunde Nagbo. I said, was, but she passed. We buried her too sadly. that you took me today. Tulanagui means God is with us. My father was a tough nut to crack, but eventually he came along. I decided years later that I would wear African clothes because I wanted to continue to learn to love this African culture. And there you have it. And now what might you say has that to do with the internet and what you're going to do here today? Well, these laptops, what you will be learning are tools. Who you are, what you believe, what your vision is, it will really dictate what you make of these tools. And so part of that story was what I was making of my life. That's the real driver. Those are the real motivators. These can be instruments and tools. Now, my goal here in this short time is to challenge and inspire, is to also have you know the power that you have and inspire you to use the internet and computing as tools to help you live out that power that you have to create the world that you want to create. Now the first challenge, however, is not to you as students directly. It's to us who are a little older, maybe graying, because many times we look to you as the future and look to you as people, young people, who will close this gap. The gap between the have and the have nots. Have you heard that? Anybody? Gap between, you know, students and people of color on the internet and whites. Heard that? Y'all heard about any of that?
Yeah.
Come on, help me now. I'm going to tell you, my grandfather was a preacher. Again, I need a little bit of interactivity. That's what the internet is about. If you don't know about it, you might say yes. You say no.
No.
Okay, great. Give me something. Be real with me.
Yes.
All right, so this gap. Now, I want to talk to you. Y'all just bear with me a little bit. You were over here, but I want to talk to the adults a little bit about the gap. This is a big thing about us, getting this gap closed. And what I want to say to us, the adults, the teachers in the room, all of us who work hard to have you here and who love you dearly, is an African proverb says, an elephant's head is no load for a child. An elephant's head is no load for a child. That is, this gap that we're talking about on the internet is reflective of the gap in income, of the gap in terms of police servicing, of the gaps in terms of birth rates and mortality rates at birth. The gap that we see in the internet is reflective of larger societal gaps. And it is our job to address them as vigorously as we address this gap. And in fact, to inspire our use of the internet so that it can lead you to address those gaps. Now us that's gray, and some of you who are dying and hiding, they're dying here. We really need you, you. And we have a responsibility to you. We've done the best we could. We're doing the best we can. We look to you, the young who are here, to stand on our shoulders so that you can see farther than we can, so that you can have a clearer vision. The question for us who are gray is, how tall are we standing? Because how far you can see, whether that's what you see in terms of your use of the internet and computing, or what you see in other aspects of your life, is really based on how tall we are standing. And the question to us, the challenge to us, is what kind of perch are we providing for you so that you, the young, can see? When our integrity is compromised many times by promotions and trinkets, the promise of promotion to change. When our intellectual curiosity, instead of peeking and standing tall, is stooping. Is sitting in front of television, watching mindless comedies, watching the ball wherever it goes. I'm not talking to young folks right now, I'm talking to old. Because it's important that we stand tall so that you have shoulders to stand on. So it is a challenge to us. Because if we want them to use it, we must show them that in our various areas, whether it's technology or not, that we are stretching as much as we can stretch. That the peaks that we provide for them to stand on will really allow them to see much further. And therein, I think, lies the motivation for them to use this. I thank you, young folks, for indulging in this message, that message to the old. Now I have a question for you. What is your vision? I just need a couple of people. How would you like your world or the world to be better? Give me three responses, please. Education? What about it? You got education now. So how would you like education to be better? You want computers in every, on every table? On every table. That's how you want it to be better. Yes, great.
A better sense of defense for ourselves.
A better sense of what?
Defense for ourselves.
Defense for ourselves. Great. Tell me what you mean by that.
Authority comes down harder on us than anybody else.
Ah, right. You want to protect yourself as young people from unwarranted attacks from authority. Put that there. Others?
Less college.
Less what?
Less college fund.
Less college fund?
I mean,
more college fund. Okay, more college fund. Okay, all right. Now, I haven't heard a female voice yet. Talk to me. Have you no vision, no ideas, no what you'd like the world to be? I don't believe that. Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me.
No more racism.
No more racism. All right. Any more? How would you like to make the world better? Or your life better? Reduce the tuition? Reduce the tuition and increase the funds. I got it. My man is heavy on education. He's ready for education. Now, the reason that I asked you this, and it's important that you really go and to explore what your ideas are, is because these are pieces of metal. All around this technology is wires and metal. It is your ideas and your ideals that will drive the technology. I interviewed a number of people preparing to come to talk to your age, and I asked them, do you use the internet? I suspect all of you here use the internet, is that true?
Yes.
And tell me, what percentage of your friends do you think use the internet at all?
Oh,
0.2. Pardon me?
0.2.
0.2? Okay. All right. Another question that I ask is, what do you use the internet for?
Homework.
Homework. What else? Entertainment. Yes.
Games.
Games, yes.
Research information.
What I found is all of those same answers I also found when I asked, now, which one do you use the most for? What would you?
Entertainment.
How did you know? Exactly. Entertainment. And mainly they said, well, you know, I like to look up my latest artists. I mean, the artists, and look up, you know, hear some of the samples from the song. So I got into it. I went to Common Sight. Anybody know Common Sense? I went to Common Sight, you know, and I checked out Asylum. you know, heard a little, you know, we got a song for Sodom. So kind of, that's really neat. And so I asked him, so, you know, and so I wanted to see what they were doing, what she was doing, because I'm kind of old folk, I'm used for boring kind of stuff. Looking up the artists, looking up whatever. And then they would say, we do research and we do papers and we look for college stuff, and I really like all of that. And I asked this other question, and I'll ask it of you. How much have you put on the internet for others to consume? Okay. Give me some hands if you have put things on the internet for others to consume. Hold them high. Okay. Now, the internet will help you be a better consumer, and so it's fine to use it to consume. However, if you are to have your ideals be realized, if you're to have the world like you want it, then you will need to input on the internet. You need to put your ideas, the kinds that you just expressed here, better education, more access to education, better defense, no racism, those will need to be out there because your words and your ideas are powerful. And part of what we're going to be doing today is having you look at how many ways you can put yourself out there on the internet, how you can use it as a tool to make your world, the world that you want, come true. That's really what it's about. Now, I'm a storyteller. I wanted to bring my djembe. You know what a djembe is? Anybody a djembe drum? I started taking lessons. I've been playing around for years, but I started taking lessons, and I really want to carry that. But I thought of people, of the gentleman in the baggage folks throwing my djembe around. And if they crack my djembe, and I just got a new head on it, I would really be missing. So I decided I couldn't bring my djembe. I wanted it on the table, but I was going to pass it. But the djembe is a symbol of old-fashioned storytelling. I had to decide right during this period whether I would talk to you like this or whether I would click and have you look at the screen. What we need is an old-fashioned and new tech together. Because this kind of, what are your ideas, this kind of need of you, this kind of inspiration, this kind of contact is critical for motivation. It's critical for understanding. And then we begin to tell stories here. I want to tell you a story about a gentleman, and some of you, when we enter the workshop part, you'll get to know more. This man, when he was a child, he was born in Nigeria. He was Igbo. And his father was doing pretty good work, and his family was doing pretty good. And then there became a civil war. And his family was thrust into poverty. And he was hungry a lot of the time. His father insisted that he learn mathematics and would time him and have him remember and be able to not only do multiplication tables, but complex math problems like that. He continually drilled. His son, who was impoverished and hungry, but still having been fed intellectually and having his father having a high standard, when he went to take this exam, they decided that he must have been cheating because he went and finished an exam in 5 minutes that supposed to take 2 hours. They said, no, it must be wrong. Some of you will remember, have you seen the video Stand and Deliver? Have you seen the video? Saying that kind of thing. You couldn't possibly know how to do this. Well, he did. He did not get his certificate because they did not believe him. He managed to leave the area and become here. And when he got here to the United States, he took an equivalency exam and passed it. It was given by a university. And he passed it and began to apply himself mathematically. He did extremely well. And then he went to Washington, D.C. after graduating with a couple graduate degrees and hit the brick wall of racism. He ended up without a job, even though he was tremendously skilled and highly technical. And again, hungry. And he said, the hunger that I felt in Washington, D.C. was like the hunger that I felt in Africa. But his stomach hunger was no match for his hunger for life. And he overcame that. And he decided that he would get back involved in technology, and he did, and began to be hooked up with scientists who were in the early development of the internet, before it was called the internet, was helping to design all kinds of things. He had got access to many of the supercomputers. In fact, the government said, we got five of these, maybe eight, I can't remember, five or eight of these centers. They cost $30 million, and these are serious scientist research centers. And he applied, and because of the level of work he was doing, they gave him a pass and a password. When he got to one of the centers, the gentleman there saw that he was African and denied him entry. He said, this is for serious research. So this Nigerian man, born in poverty, was turned away again, even though he was technological genius. Again, his hunger for life was greater than the racism he faced. He decided that since he had access to some of the smaller centers, he would do it anyway. He set a record in 1989, I do believe. He set a record of the most calculations per second. 3.1 billion calculations per second. Not on a supercomputer, but by using his access to many computers, he created a network of parallel processing, has 65,000 computers, basically PCs, tied together doing parallel processing, created what's called the connection machine, won the Nobel Prize of Technology, and his invention allowed oil industry to do much more recovery of oil in places they hadn't been before. And at this point, this man, whose name is Philip Inwale, has started a project called Africa One, where he's connecting the whole continent so that when you make a telephone call from Nigeria to Tanzania, it doesn't have to go to Europe. He's connecting fiber optics around the country, around the continent. You will learn more about him in the particular workshop. We'll go to his website. I tell you this story because you will face obstacles. What I'm hoping and what I take from his story, and I hope you do, is that your hunger for life, for the ideals and ideas that you have, is greater than the stomach pains that will be occasioned by your not being at the top of your game, or being rebuffed by racism or sexism or whatever. I want to not delay this anymore. I want you to get to where you put your hands on the computer, where you are exposed to some of the genius edits that we have here and have assembled here to work with you today. I want you to be in it. I will leave you with a quote by Intaju Caswell. She's part of In Process, and she's a trainee of Sweet Honey in the Rock. If you don't know Sweet Honey in the Rock, get to know her. I mean them. Preheat your faith to 365 degrees. Into an open mind, slowly mix the following ingredients. 7 ounces of willpower. 1 pound of patience, 3 heaping tablespoons of perseverance, and 9 pinches of knowledge. Cover with love and let stand until it begins to rise beyond your expectation. In the meantime, stuff your open heart with equal parts of compassion and understanding. Take out your largest casserole dish. All it with all your ideas. Take the open mind and the stuffed heart. Place them side by side in the casserole. Bake forever, forever inside your faith, and life's expectations will let you know when it's done. Bon appetit.
Thank you, Jason. Now comes your work and your challenge of the day. I want you to begin to take a look at your badges. I'm going to tell you where you're going to go and what you're going to do. First,
I'd like to talk a little bit about the impact of the internet on teachers, as what the mission, in a sense, is with respect to teaching the internet, and what the big challenges are as we all see it. And then I'm going to throw the ball to Bob, who has got a structured presentation to make to you about research. He has developed a treasure hunt, which he's hoping to take us all on when we get to the interactive part of this. We move at, when is it we move?
At noon, I believe.
We move at noon to a place where we all basically get our hands on machines, and where we can, I don't know, test out the treasure hunt, see if it's fun, see if it works as a kind of approach to drawing kids at the beginning. So let me just start myself by describing what the challenge of the internet has been for me as a teacher. Tell us who you are.
My name is Hazaz. I'm the coordinator of the Orion High School. I was supposed to be here a little earlier, but I decided to drive home, which is a big mistake. It took me a while.
Okay, good. Well, I've been a teacher all my life, really. I started teaching in 1966, which I suspect is before I was born. I've taught in law school, but the fact is teaching. If you're teaching as your profession, you understand that ultimately it's the relationship with kids that counts, not so much the relationship with information. The big challenge of internet in the world that I'm familiar with is teachers actually giving into the fact that they are guides and students, and more than instructors and teachers. This is a medium that I'm sure you're all overwhelmed by in some sense, insofar as it catches on to it faster than older folks. And kids know more very often than we do. And it's a matter of opening yourself up to the sense that you don't have to be in total command at all times, and there are surprises around every corner. The Berkman Center, which I direct, along with Charles Ogletree, was founded with the idea that the cyber environment, this internet environment, doesn't exist until you build it. It wasn't there a short time ago. In terms of the language of New Frontier, hi.
How are
you? Hi, tell us who you are.
My name is Ibrahim. I work with the Canfield Estates Neighborhood Technology Center.
How are you?
All right, yourself?
So when Columbus discovered America, theoretically discovered America, the resources of the place were all here. You know, the mountains were here, and the rivers and the valleys, and all of the resources. And the way people built wealth was they captured those resources and made them private, in a sense. This frontier is new in the sense that it didn't exist before it was built, and in fact it has to be built, and the way it's built has a great deal to do with what the future is going to be like. From the point of view of educating kids to me, the challenge is to communicate to kids the sense that the challenge is to become creators in the media, not merely consumers. So for example, when we talk about digital divide, the objective of trying to bridge digital divides is, to me, the challenge of developing capacity, indigenous capacity, to create and control the media, as opposed to simply extending access to the media and making people consumers and customers. That's a critical difference. It's primarily a difference in aspiration. This is a medium that's clearly wide open, growing exponentially, and if it's possible to communicate the sense of openness and adventure and opportunity to kids, then that's the plus. I believe myself that education is much too much a matter of teaching kids when to quit. That kids go into schools really addicted to learning. That's kindergarten, first grade, second grade, you just see kids immensely excited by learning. And then a process sets in where it's sit in your seat, take your turn, add, subtract, divide, do fractions, do long division, do algebra, do calculus, and the whole process seems to evolve into an approach that is more or less designed to challenge kids to see when they're going to quit. And the idea for kids gets to be to see if they can find something that they're good at, something that allows them to go on and find some route through the system. That's a very negative view of education, but it's one that I think is generally descriptive as far as I can think of it. And internet comes along as this open fund. It's like looking at it from the other end. It's possible to get kids in to the point where they feel themselves empowered to look around, to learn stuff. There's a little potential to reverse that kind of process. So now, help me out. I'd love to hear what you feel the challenge is. Carolyn, you're always good to start. What's the challenge of internet as far as you're concerned?
Well, certainly the challenge is access. I'm in a fully wired school with lots of centers, but if kids don't have free roam outside of school, you know, that's that cutoff process. So I've traveled in with a young person who I think has significant skills but doesn't have access at home or beyond, you know. And libraries, if you can get access, it's an hour. If you're lucky, if you can get on, you have to call well in advance to get on, because it's everybody clamoring to one space to get a spot. And my experience is that the greatest development is when you have that free reign, when you can go as far as you want to before you decide to quit, just to use your paradigm.
Yeah. How about you, Brian?
I think the biggest difficulty we have at our school is that the kids are beyond the teachers. I mean, we have a computer lab, and the students go on the internet. I mean, they're more savvy than I am in terms of getting to the places, downloading things, and finding out like games and music and artists, and just thinking. The question is, how do one we get teachers to a point where they're comfortable enough with the technology and not inferior, that their students know more than what they actually do. And then another concern of mine is, how do we take that quest that students have to learn about their artists, to learn about downloading games, and then put an academic twist on it so that they can research information on physics or science or an academic subject where it's just not for entertainment purposes. I think that's the hardest thing. What I like to do is I like to expose my kids to a lot and say in terms of real world, this is the group that I brought with me. Last year I introduced them to the stock market game. This year, for the most part, they were in the top three ranking in our region. know how to go to different websites to research.
Top three in terms of the investment from the market?
Their portfolio, in terms of rank in the region.
How they doing? Because
it's down there. Oh, horrible. The market took a terrible hit. But it's a learning experience, and what I try to do is I try to make it real to them. We at our school, we have a lot of equipment, we have a lot of tools, we have access to it. It's just a matter of the time and the teacher training is the most important thing. How do you train teachers to become technology savvy, but then also the things that teachers have to do with preparing curriculum, like correcting papers, talking to parents? It's a whole judgment act. That's a big one.
Gali, what do you think?
Well, I'm new to the school, to the O'Brien, so from that perspective, it looks to me like they're doing a good job at my experience in this, because before I started working at the O'Brien, I used to work at the community center in Dorchester, and I used to run a computer and a web design program for middle school and high school students. And my job was sort of to turn an after-school activity that they were supposed to do, as he says, play games and download stuff and try to get them to do something more than that, do something academic with that. And in my experience, I found that the best way that works was by setting up projects for them, where they would get the tools to research, where I would teach them about different search engines and how the internet was set up, and in turn they would be able to use that to research and do projects on something that they were interested in. That way they sort of found it in after school activity, but yet I was able to teach them sort of through that. So that means about the internet, where it started, how it started, and the importance of it.
So internet not as an end in itself, but as a means to generate the project.
I think it was when I attempted to teach a sort of like as a means, it was the first difficult because some of the other people I didn't understand the internet, so I had to take the time out to teach the other people in the center and make sure they felt comfortable enough to help the kids out, and not so that, as he said, they would feel like the kids knew more than they did. And it sort of became like they don't really want to do that, they want to play games and stuff, and you sort of had to find a way in which they would be entertained, that they would be interested and sort of learn about it without really knowing that they were being taught. So it's sort of like putting a curve on it.
Is it Mary?
Hello?
My
love. Hello.
My eyes are, they used to be better.
I do have to agree with Brian and I'm not much of a computer. I use the internet for helping out with class lessons, but I definitely am miles below your kids in terms of what they're doing on the internet. So.
Does it feel bad? I mean, is it like frightening? And not know as much as the kids know, and yet be responsible somehow for controlling the environment.
Well, I'm pretty good in terms of asking them how they know things and having them showing things, and that works out fine. I often forget. I don't continue to use it as they do. I've used the internet for social studies, or done it for projects that we do on countries or research projects, and. It works out fine, but I don't know how to kind of, I guess, get the full benefits of the internet. I'm certainly probably at that lower echelon of tapping into the resources.
Julian.
I'm a resident of Chilada, and the Garrison Heights were encouraged to say it's time to use the internet for their research. And as soon as they have the time, sooner progress. They can find things very easily when they do a research for a project, but this is a day where they can do it on their own. And they're definitely going to watch videos and read about songs, which are a little bit frustrating because I feel like they can do that outside. They don't need the internet to do that. They can watch TV or they can read magazines. So I try night forms, try to find them sites to be entertaining for them, but in a way also they can learn something. And late recently I found a site that was targeting teenage girls, and
But we're raising different issues that we do in our magazines, with every other particular sites where they go. So that's my, one of my focus, is doing that. For them to learn how to use the internet in a different way. And also to be able to communicate with other people actually some issues. Maybe. Not only purely internet.
So one of the things that I'm hearing is that, tell me if this is actually a common theme, that is we're actually in some doubt about what it is we want to teach kids about internet. It's a tool for doing a number of things, but how, what is it that we want to teach? We teach some search techniques, but with search techniques alone, they won't find sites to read about their favorite stars, and somehow that doesn't feel academic enough. Is that?
I enjoy to see my students, you know, go learn how to download, go to different websites. I find it interesting. I do it after school. I mean, they show me different like websites, and what we do to, the biggest thing that we want to do is use it to, along with the curriculum frameworks and my curriculum in our school. So we use math websites, flashcards for students to go online and actually do math problems. So that's interactive. You might have a student who, if you're just writing, doing math problems on pencil and paper, they might find it boring. But if you go online, a student who likes the computer, and this helps with special ed students specifically, they like to interact with the computer and actually see the problems. They will perform better because they like using the computer, just the fact that they're on the computer. And the internet, you can use it as that. What we're starting to do is compile a lot of websites, math websites that our students can use. There isn't so much them going out and being able to that. It's how do you find that balance? And I think teaching students how to search the internet is very important. But then having teachers be able to create projects, I think that time planning those projects is difficult for teachers to do. I would like to find a balance where students can use it as an entertainment purposes, but then also that they can use it for academic purposes. But if you don't set up a structure for the academic purposes, I don't see students just want to join it.
Is there any interest in teaching about issues of the internet? What I mean by that is issues that have to do with privacy on the internet, the way the internet affects democracy, internet voting as something that's clearly coming into the future, principles of the internet, like the idea of networking and what networking actually is, architecture of the internet, is what is it physically, how does it work, why has it created this great innovation, history of the internet, how did it get to be here, what is the historical flow, how did this happen, seeming to come upon us in the last few years. Is there interest actually in the issues of the internet? Is that something that it would be a subject to go to?
I would be interested in the history of the research.
I'm sorry.
The history of the internet and how to go about doing more research.
I think some of those issues still have to be wrapped around teen issues. I think if you want to talk about intellectual property rights, we can wrap that around copyright laws, music, the controversy around the release of the technology for DVDs. I think when you're working with teens and young people, you still have to wrap it around their issues.
So for instance, it's a big deal. The big deal in the university world right now is Napster. Do you know what Napster is yet? It's taken it to play it for it. Music is the cutting edge in intellectual property. There are two kinds of property in the world. Property that's made out of atoms, physical things, physical objects,
And then this stuff is made out of ideas and equivalent in the internet spaces. That's made out of bits. And music used to be something that was physically connected with atoms. That is, when you bought music, you had to buy a physical record or a physical CD or a physical tape. But the big revolution in the internet is that it permitted the separation of the music from the physical container. And as soon as the music is separated from the physical container, it becomes just like an idea, in the sense that whereas real property, only one person can have it at a time, and you get the idea of trespass. With an idea, it can be replicated as much as possible and multiply shared. And so when music gets to be bits disconnected from a physical companion object, it can be shared all around. Right? And as soon as that happens, the whole structure of intellectual property, the recording industry, the record industry, feels tremendous threat. So the first thing that happened, the history of this particular subject, is the first thing that happened is that people loaded music onto sites and kids could connect through the internet to the site and download music. These are pirate sites. And the industry says, well, how do we stop that? Well, their first choice is to go after the people who are doing the downloading. But that doesn't really work, because that's all of us. That's all the kids. Those are the customers. And so for the industry to try and go after those people and punish them is like punishing your own customers. It just doesn't work. And so the first thing the industry really did was go after the pirate sites. And for a while, there was this cat and mouse game where pirate sites would develop, the industry would come after them, they'd get repressed, they'd pop up someplace else, and there was this kind of game that was going on. That all changed with the advent of more powerful networks. So far, this is a phenomenon of university worlds. In the university worlds, there are very good networks. So that the typical student at a university has the ability to plug a machine in to a network and leave it on all the time. So there's 24/7, 365, very good internet connection. Now, what that means basically is that everybody's machine is part of one big network. And Napster is this extremely interesting product, simple in its way, which basically creates a directory of all of the music that's on the network. So that if Caroline's on with her computer and she's got some MP3, that's the format that was popular with the compression of the music. If she's got some MP3 files on her machine, and Bob's got some MP3 files on his machine, and Julian's got some on his machine, Napster creates a file directory so that I can go on to Napster and I can say, I'd like to find Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, and I will find that music, no matter where it is, anywhere, in the whole community of people who are connected. And I can immediately download it. It's like Bob's machine becomes part of my machine. It's not that there's any pirate site anywhere. It's a distributed system. And that looks like the death knell to the recording industry. They're totally petrified by that. And there are those who have said basically that one of the biggest issues of the internet is the fact that all of the information that's in this form of bits and starts with music, but as soon as things get a little bit more powerful, it means movies, videos, anything that can be reduced to bits can be passed around like this without anybody centrally controlling it. And so it becomes the single most cutting-edge issue in the legal world. That's where the power fights are going on right now. So yeah, that's an extremely important issue that's happened. So far, it won't really have hit the high school world because you don't have good enough networks yet.
But could I download from my PC?
You could.
I'd have to be on the university net to do it?
No, it'd be slower for you.
Right, but I could get to the site.
You go on just on your modem, and you go to Napster.com, and you download the little Napster program.
What's the spell of it?
N-A-P-S-T-E-R.
I'm sure the kids know it all, because I mean, they're all talking about downloading.
Yeah, some will know, some won't. It depends on the audience, but it's a really good measure of where an audience is to ask them how many of you have got Napster on your machine. How many of you have downloaded, the way the industry would put it, how many of you have downloaded illegally copyrighted music, illegally copied music, right? Yeah.
I have a question though. The people who are running Napster.com, where are they getting the music?
They don't get the music. All they do is supply the file directory. So it's just like you go on your machine before you're connected with anybody, and you have a directory of the stuff that's on your hard disk.
So they create a directory made up of different MP3s that are just on the internet?
Right. That is when if you go to Napster.com, you download the Napster program to your machine, and the very fact that you're downloading it, whenever you're online, that download to you puts your MP3 files, just the pointers to them, not the actual file, but just the pointers to them, into a common directory. And that means that when Bob goes on Napster looking for something, if what he's looking for is on your machine, he'll see the pointer, and he clicks on it, and his machine connects with your machine, and he can download it from your machine. It never goes through Napster. It's just the directory.
So these are sort of like a search engine?
They are a search engine. That's exactly what it is. It's a form of the search engine. And so the industry is now trying to come after Napster and stuff. But the problem that they have with Napster is that the program that creates this directory is a pretty simple program. They may be able to stop Napster, but the next thing that comes up is GNU Napster or PNAP. I mean, this program is proliferating, so it looks like it's going to be pretty tough for the industry.
Is there a current standing law about whether it is or isn't illegal currently to download by using Napster? What's the legal or current legal or ethical implications or point of view on people that are doing it now?
It's illegal.
It is illegal.
You are copying something that is copyrighted, and it's illegal, but one of the things about law is that law has its boundaries in practical enforcement. If law can't practically enforce something, it starts to fall apart. Kind of like we've been playing on borders and enforcement with lots of things, really. No matter what the laws, right through the copyright laws. It's a question of whether there's enough enforcement power to control it. And it's a very big question at this point. It's not limited. Music is just a canary in the mine. It's just the beginning of it, but it extends to DVD. Well, do you all know what DVD is? The big issue with DVD now, these are the issues of the internet. DVD is a compression technology for video, and the movie industry was very cautious about wanting to put movies into digital format. Because as soon as they're in digital format, that means they can be perfectly copied. And whoops, if they get out of control, they're done. And so what they tried to do was, in effect, put the intellectual property, the bits, back in a container, except that in the internet world, the container that you put them in is made of encryption. And really, all encryption is more bits. It's just a complicated mesh of bits that encase stuff. But the difficulty is that the more powerful you make the encryption container for your property, the more powerful the machine is that has to process to download it, to play it. So that if you're in the business of selling DVDs, if you encase them in really powerful encryption, it means you limit your market to people who have really powerful machines. And so there's this conflict that comes up really between the hardware industry, the people that make the machines and want to have a mass market for their machines and want to be able to say, yes, hey, if you have this machine, you can play DVDs, and the interests of the copyright holder who wants not to have their bits escape the encryption file. So in fact, what happened is that there was a compromise and the DVD industry put out its DVD standard with very weak encryption. It's encrypted, but it's not really serious. And what happened was somebody figured out how to decrypt it and wrote a little decryption program, which was supposed to be about as difficult as an advanced computer science student having a two-day assignment, but it's not too tough, in other words. And the program that breaks the DVD encryption and proliferates on the net, so it's all over the place. And suddenly, anybody that's got their stuff in the DVD encryption bottle is vulnerable to having it downloaded and copied. So once again, you get this tremendous tension. That's what's going on in the law courts now. That's the struggles over whether it's the copyright industry coming to judges and asking judges to impose orders that will try and stop the process of breaking into encryption. And frankly, the judges are saying, well, we're not sure we've got the power to stop this. We can make orders, but if you make an order and nobody obeys the order, then it's the law that comes into disrepute. And so unless you can back it up with something that's real, then we may not go there. So these are really the issues of the internet at this point, the way in which it's changing society in quite fundamental fashion. I don't know, I think that it raises a question for teachers of internet as to whether it would make sense to start from where the kids are, with what they're doing, and actually connect them to the conceptual issues of the internet. This is beyond just a particular search engine. This is really about how this phenomenon of the internet is affecting the society.
Yeah, you know, as you're talking, Charlie, I was thinking, it's also true of everything that's digital. I mean, I've been in schools long enough when beepers were illegal and negative, and we said you couldn't have them. Now we have parents giving them to kids because they want to know where they are at all times. All the kids have them. So now we say, don't turn it on, because we can't stop it. We can't tell every kid, put your beeper in the locker when you come into school. So now we say to them, don't have it, make noise during class, or we'll take it. Then when you take it, the parent calls and says, listen, I gave that to that kid, so he or she would respond to me, but I want to know where they're at. It's more than just what the original image was, only drug dealers or doctors and beepers. It's now a basic tool of a generation. And that's a vehicle for those of us who just traditionally use a telephone. We're out of that loop. Because many adults have them for business purposes, but it's a means of communication for youth. And so we had, certainly in the schools, we had to adjust to not deal with whether you have it, but how it's used in the environment. Because otherwise, it's just something that you can't regulate. You just don't want them all going off at the same time in school.
Right.
And now companies give them away because they make more money by the service than they do by selling it. And I would argue that the way to get kids and people conversing on the net is to give the computers away. One day, they'll give the hardware away. Seriously, they need to give the hardware away, because then you gotta buy the software. And that's where all of these encryption issues come up. Because once somebody can break the code of software, then the box is open.
Yeah. Any other thoughts and reactions here? How about you on the camera back there? I see you nodding your head every once in a while. Keep running.
Well, I have to say that standing here listening, I did learn a bit about the whole breakdown on the molecular bits and the physical bits. So that was quite interesting. I do remember at one time when we had pagers in schools that were getting taken, and now it's at a point where I'm outside of the school and I'm hearing an issue where the pages are now allowed, and I really don't know where to put my finger on it, except to say that when I was younger, I noticed that the system was like, it was just strong, and the more issues that are brought up, my mind is telling me that it just seems like the system is becoming more and more weak, and in terms of control, I don't know how much control you can have if, like, majority of the children out here. Like, I was watching MTV the other day, and some of the biggest hackers were like 14 and 15, and I'm sitting here saying to myself, well, I don't see a possible way of the system gaining any real type of control if more of the youth out here take their curiosity and want to break the software codes, and, you know, wanna get into the internet and destroy websites. I mean, that's my question right there. I really don't see the system somehow gaining any real strength in terms of discipline. You know, it's
changing.
Yeah, it is.
It's like the system faces the same problem the teachers face in their way. It's just at a bigger level. You know, the environment is changing in ways that, I mean, you can't control it in the way you used to be able to control it. And you're challenged to go with the flow and figure out what the new environment is and work out means of